You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 104. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are digging deep with Norma Gregory, African Diaspora Industrial Heritage Historian. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute Peoples, Treaty Lands, the Dineta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. So today, obviously, we have Dr. Norma Gregory on the show. Born in Nottingham, UK in 1969, Dr. Norma Gregory is founder and director of Nottingham News Center, a freelance EDI, or DEI for those of you in the US, heritage media social enterprise since 2013. Dr. Norma Gregory, a heritage leader and consultant, has a passion for education, for sharing and celebrating inclusive heritage, and provides innovation through content writing, interpretation, and creative arts to inspire and enlighten others. So welcome to the show, Dr. Gregory.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you.
Okay. So you're coming to the show with a little bit different of a background than a lot of our other guests, which I'm very excited about.
Yes.
We are the Archaeology Podcast Network, but I love to have non-archaeologist guests because, as I already said, I'm also not an archaeologist. So love to have non-archaeologist guests. And I'm particularly also excited to have you on because I know a lot of our listeners, you know, are archaeologists or other types of anthropologists, historians, land managers, et cetera. And so they're trained in their specific field, but they're not trained in education. And you do have training in education. So I think this episode will really benefit a lot of our listeners. So very excited. So that all being said, could you give us a little bit of an intro into the type of work that you do and maybe a couple quick examples?
Yes. I am a Black woman, a person of African Caribbean heritage, born in the UK, born in Nottingham here. And I'm probably one of the first Black industrial mining historians in the UK. There aren't that many of us, probably in the world, but in the UK, there are very few of us, but I'm proud to be one. I have spent the last 15 years collating and preserving and celebrating the history of former coal miners of African and Caribbean heritage living in the UK, born in the UK, or who have migrated to the UK. That work has absolutely changed my life, changed my world, changed my understanding of our community, the work that people used to do of all nationalities that have lived here in the UK, which is a multicultural country. It always has been. I set about, it's been a personal journey. It's been my calling. It's been a life calling, and it still is. I'm still very much very active. I'm just about to send out an exhibition to a school in Wales on Monday to teach them and do some online work with them and visit the school as well next year. So the work I'm doing has been over the many years. I thoroughly enjoy it. I do it because the community wanted it done. The community in the UK is diverse and has many different communities and nationalities living here, working here. The Black community in particular, the community, when I say Black, I mean of the African diaspora. So mainly in the UK, there's a lot of Jamaicans, a lot of West Indians, Barbadians, Indians, Ghanaians, Nigerians, yes. So very diverse, and they have always contributed to the development, the economic development, social development, and more in this country, and always will, because we actually helped to build this country over centuries. Yes. So my work has been helping to ensure that the lived experiences, what these miners did, what they did underground, very tough, hard environment that they worked in for sustained periods, for decades. Some of them, I've interviewed over 70 miners, and many of them talked about working underground for 30 years, 25 years, which was unbelievable when I learned about this. I was not taught about mining history at school. I live in an area where they were former deep coal mines. There aren't any more deep coal mines working in the UK. The last one was closed in December 2015. So there aren't any more deep coal mines here. But the memory of the past of mining is still very present in the country, on the land. Archaeologists are looking into the remains of industrial history, of mining history. And this is why I've got into archaeology, because it's brought me my kind of search for understanding of the story of Britain has led me to archaeology. So that's why I'm involved in archaeology now. I'm looking at some of the remnants of the machinery, which is now on the land. So these parts that were working underground, the train lines and train rings and all the kind of things what the miners used to dig out the coal and bring it to the surface, these large objects, these were living, moving machines, but now they are still, now they are, you know, kind of fossils, really, but they are on the land and they're absolutely incredible. I go and visit, as I've visited many all over the country, and I think, wow, look at that. If we, what, you know, what are young people thinking when they see these monuments? What are they? So my job is to help to explain that, help young people, not just young people, older people as well, walk past and think, oh, that's, what's that? Oh, that's a pit wheel, or that's headstocks. So I kind of help with the education side. I'm a qualified teacher. I qualified some years ago in 2010. I qualified as an English teacher and media studies as well. I've studied media before my English degree. So much into interviewing people, talking to people, writing about things, creating content, educational content that explains and interprets industrial history to as many people as possible, as wide as we can go. I'm willing to take the story of Britain there, because it needs to be widespread. It needs to be talked about. We actually need to engage with other countries to share our skills and our knowledge with other countries, to help them also understand what they could do to improve education around industrial history.
Yeah. Okay. I'm like so tempted to ask a different question, but I'm going to ask the more basic question first, and then we'll come back to my other question that ties into what you just said right there. But okay, so you talked a little bit about this already, but could you talk about what brought you to this specifically? Like you mentioned, the community Yes. was asking for it. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. Well, I wrote a book called Jamaicans in Nottingham, and two of the chapters were about coal miners. Mm-hmm. Just by chance, I realized I'd interviewed a contributor, a man in the book, and this man was part of my family. It was my dad's first cousin, and they moved mm-hmm. to England from Jamaica. One of them moved in the 50s and my dad moved early 60s. But the cousin, Vernon Gregory, he became a miner, and he was a miner for 28 years. He never spoke about that when he used to come and visit the house to see my father, who worked. My father worked in the iron industry in Nottinghamshire for all of his life before he died. And I interviewed Vernon Gregory about his life, and he explained his life as a miner. And I was really confused, because I didn't know about, I'd heard some of the workers, miners talk about the pit, but I never was explained this, what it meant at school. There was just kind of silence around this. So I spent some time just talking to local people, whether they knew any miners, industrial workers, and few names kept popping up. And the more people I spoke to, the more names kept coming forward. So I just kept, I set a kind of target to do so many interviews each week. And I just went round and sat with the speakers and let them explain their lived experience working as a miner in the UK in an English deep coal mine. I was just amazed and shocked, and I it took me time to process their stories. I asked them stories about how they migrated to the UK, if they came to the UK, or whether they were born in the UK. Those people who migrated to the UK, I asked them about their journey, you know, why did they want to come to the UK? And many of them spoke about the opportunities that were offered to them by the British government in that time in the 50s to come post-war. This is post-war Britain. The Second World War was 1939 to 45. So after the Second World War and the First World War, a lot of bombing damage happened in the UK. There was a lot of men and women who were killed during the war. So the work numbers, you know, the workers were down in numbers. So the British government asked people from the Commonwealth countries to come to Britain. They invited them to Britain. They were given British passports to come as British citizens that they were, and which they did. A lot of army personnel moved over. Workers with higher education and skilled workers left the Caribbean and other Commonwealth countries to come here to help. So that was a big kind of learning curve, just finding out that journey, the 3-week crossing to Britain, and they're welcome or not when they arrived, and the jobs they took up in this country for a prolonged period of time. So their stories just made me think, wow, you know, where is this documented in any industrial history book that I've read or mining book that I've read? I couldn't find anything. And I just kept going through archives, contacting archives all over the country, trying to find stories of black miners in libraries, in exhibitions. I could find just a few little pieces of information. So I thought I needed to do something about it. So my first stop was the National Coal Mining Museum, which is in Wakefield in Yorkshire. And I set up a meeting there with the director at the time and spoke to him about my concerns that there wasn't enough mentioned in the museum about the diverse communities that have contributed to the British history of mining here. So that was really my starting point, and there was recognition that more needed to be done. So I said, right, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do something about it. I'm not going to complain. I'm just going to help shape what we learn about industrial history in the UK. So that was my starting point, really, in 2000. And the book came out 2015, but I'd started researching my book in 2009. I was a teacher, full-time teacher at the time as well, and I left my teaching job. I said, right, this is my work that I need to do. I need to help educate the world around inclusive heritage, industrial heritage, and the different voices that are involved in our global story of industrial history. So that was really my starting point. And also, I wasn't educated about this at school. So it was something I questioned why. All through my research, the main thing I do is question why. I want to know why. I'm always asking why. I think that's what learners need to do. You need to start asking why, asking questions. So that's what I just started to do. I started to just work out what I needed to try to find out, talking to people. I've got a lot of my research from oral history. I said at the beginning, my background was in media and journalism. So I use those interview skills. I use those listening skills and writing skills to help me collate and collect and preserve this part of industrial history, which has been very good. It's a good way of using journalism to help in the heritage world in history, to help us understand more about our shared story, because it is a shared story, the story of industrial history.
Okay, I love that so much. I mean, as anyone who's been listening at all knows, I'm a cultural anthropologist, ethnographer, like I said. So the fact that you did 70 oral histories on this topic is just incredible. That's amazing. So we are already at our first break points, which is just bananas. But when we come back, I really want to hear more about, you know, decided to focus on this specifically, and I'd love to hear more about the work that you did from there to try and document and educate the public on this topic. So when we come back, we will dive right in there. Okay, so we were just saying that I'd love to hear more about your work from there. Once you decided to focus on this, how did you go about doing all of that work that you were looking forward to doing?
Yes. Well, what I did was think the first kind of content I kind of was helping to create was the interviews. So I used the miners' interviews as a starting point to really learn from their perspective, their story, to kind of embrace what they were saying. And I used that, their stories, to then create touring exhibition, which is still touring at the moment. Or from 2016, I started to put an exhibition together, and it's still touring. This exhibition is being shipped out on Monday to a school in Wales. They're taking it, and it's being all over the country. So we're always shipping out, sharing the exhibition, so young people can find out more, investigate for themselves. We've been able to work with artists to commission new artworks, new paintings, stained glass. We've worked with a stained glass artist, the local artist in Nottinghamshire called Stella Chadwick, and a painter called Honey Williams. We worked with local artists to embrace the kind of learning that we'd gathered, to interpret that their stories into new artwork, which again we share. We at the moment, some of it's housed in various buildings across the city of Nottingham and beyond, in London as well. We've shipped the artwork all over the place so people can experience it and enjoy it. I've been able to use all the artifacts and research and all the documents that we've got to produce an online museum, which we've called the Black Miners Museum. So if you wish to have a look at some of the content, if you visit www.blackcoalminers.com, that's our kind of showcase of some of the content that we've been able to put online and share with the public, so they can have a look, so we can reach new audiences all over the world who have some link, because everybody really has a link to mining. If they actually look back in their family history, there'll be someone who they know or who they're related to that's been involved with mining or some other industrial kind of work, whether it's in steel, it's in mineral mining, gold mining, there'll be someone there who has been a miner in someone's family. So it's always worth talking to your family members to find out what, you know, to ask questions about who are the people that have been in your family and what the work they used to do. Because that's really, again, where I started off. I wanted to know more. We've been able to create new educational content. I've written a series of lesson plans for teachers that's available on the Black Coal Miners website. And we're actually working with Royal Holloway University in London to help reshape some of the national curriculum. So the national curriculum in the UK is the kind of prescribed subject matter that's taught in schools, that schools could get to choose what the kind of themes that they teach. But we are helping to reshape the history curriculum to include some more stories about migration and about industries of the past, which and voices of the past, which aren't normally in the traditional curriculum that's taught in schools. And this is a big issue, because young people come out of school sometimes not understanding the types of work people used to do, and also the teamwork and camaraderie, the togetherness that happened during these work environments, which we don't necessarily have that anymore, because we're all very much technology kind of focused. We're all sat in front of computers or laptops or mobile phones. It wasn't like that all the time. You know, years gone past, you know, the past, people talk to each other a lot more. People helped each other a lot more, where now we're in a bit of a fragmented world. But yeah, we're connected with technology, but the kind of social element has kind of faded a little bit in the world that we live in. But in the past, and especially on underground, the men, and it was men up until 1842 in the UK, women worked underground and children did as well. But 1842, the law was changed that stopped women deep coal mining. They worked on the surface. So the curriculum, I'm very much into helping to modernise curriculum, that it's more inclusive, that it's more representative of the communities that have served in various roles in countries all over the world. So I'm very much into the educational side, as I am a qualified teacher. I'm very passionate about what we teach young people in school. So that's one of the things that's been, all those elements have been the outcome of conversations with people about the past and how the past is shaping the world we're living in today.
Yeah. And I noticed that you did, I mean, obviously, so you're just talking about doing a lot of, you know, lesson plan, education kit, working with local artists. And I noticed at the online museum also that you also talked about some different types of projects where it was more physically on the landscape, like plaques or street names or things like that. So why do you think it's important to have like that aspect as well, like where it's physically on the landscape?
Yes, very much so. I think it's so important. We've had streets named after former miners, at least three in Nottingham alone. And hopefully we're going to have more of that. Yes, these monuments and these kind of the remnants of mining and industrial history, it should be recognised. It should be, you know, they need to be explained more, because sometimes you can walk past the pit wheel that's on the roadside and you're wondering what it is. You know, I think there needs to be more interpretation. And this could be, you know, using technology, using QR codes, making it, pinpointing them on maps, on digital maps, on Google Maps. You know, I think more can be done with technology to educate and show people where these monuments are. So that's some of the work that I'm trying to do. I'm doing, at the moment, I'm 3D scanning some of these monuments in my local area into 3D models. So again, I can share with schools that they can have a look, because schools sometimes can't get to take children out on trips anymore because of lack of funding. So I want to try to help bring industrial history into the classroom, bring mm-hmm. archaeology into the classroom through technology. So that's something mm-hmm. that I'm working on now. And luckily, I've been given a small grant by the UK Association for Industrial History and Industrial Heritage. I went on a conference, their conference, a few months back, visiting many industrial sites in the Yorkshire area, which was absolutely amazing. We visited different railway stations, mining sites. It was superb. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I met so many amazing people who are also sharing their passion and knowledge for industrial archaeology across the UK. So I'm very proud to be a member of the association.
Yeah. And so one thing that I wanted to specifically ask you about that I think a lot of our listeners could really benefit from, you know, talking about that, you know, public engagement aspect of all of our work, that I think some of us that are trained more in the nitty-gritty specifics of the field can sometimes have a hard time with. Could you talk a little bit about ways that people can make their work a little bit more accessible or things to keep in mind if they're working with different formats?
Yes.
For educating the public?
Yes. Well, audience engagement and accessibility is so crucial in the world today. People have got to be, they've got to be able to engage and relate to whatever we're trying to teach them. So we've got to think about how we're presenting history, making it interesting, making it accessible, making it that people can also feedback and give their comments and give their opinion as well and share their stories as well. So I think that's really crucial, and that's something that I'm really passionate about. You know, all my work is around inclusion. It's around equality and diversity, diversity of story, diversity of race and community groups that are involved in history. So I think as a practitioner, industrial heritage educator, I think that's crucial to make sure that whatever we're putting out there, people can access it either online or visit one of our exhibitions. People like to read, especially young people do actually like to read. They see them when I go to different bookshops. I see young people sat there with a book reading, which is amazing. Since COVID, I think a lot of young people are kind of enjoying reading a lot more. So yeah, just making industrial history and archaeology as a topic fun, colourful, inclusive of voice, different voices, women's voices, young people's voices, senior people to have their faces and voices, because that's one of the major things that I did during my research over the last 15 years is to collate and create images, the photographs. I did a series of portraiture. I worked with a local photographer and we captured the photography. We created portraits of 10 miners, which again, there weren't any pictures of these men. very few pictures of a miner, a black miner in clothing, mining clothing, or contemporary pictures of miners. So again, I said I was going to do something about that and create new content, new photography, and also obviously research archive images of black miners, look, you know, in their work clothes, had to search and search. And I actually got donations from people sending in photographs as well. So I've got to really thank the public in all this work, and volunteers as well who have given and given. And that's why this work has to continue, because it's what the people want. It's what the community want. They are insisting on this. So my job as a facilitator is to make sure the people get heard and they get seen and they get remembered as well. It's about the legacy of industrial history that is no more in the UK. Mining does take place all over the world, and it always will, because of the technology that we have nowadays, the minerals that are involved in a lot of machinery, mobile phones, laptops, computers, they are all including parts, minerals that have to be mined. So that's the reality. It would just be great if considerations were made for the workers, fair pay for women, fair pay for the workers' health is managed and looked after. There should be no one suffering who was a miner. There should be no living miners who are suffering, and they are suffering today, in that their pensions is still an issue, getting medical treatment for lung diseases, infections, and that a lot of them have injuries that they sustained underground, they're living with in silence. So though the workers should not be in that state, they should not. They should be receiving support, mental health support, physical health support. Yeah, so their lives, they live on beyond, life continues beyond mining. So those are the things that I really campaign for globally across the world, where mining is taking place, and it is all over the world today. We have to think about the environment, the physical land. We have to think about accidents, preventing accidents, and, you know, mining collapse and other issues, water pollution, air pollution. There's many things that are kind of sadly linked to mining. So, you know, it is for mining companies to think about the bigger picture and to really reflect on their mission and values and their journey going ahead in the future, and how they are also, how they can contribute to a better society and better environment that we all share.
Yeah. Do you know of any specific organizations that are like really taking up this charge, in case our listeners want to support those kind of efforts?
Well, in the UK, there's Greenpeace. They do some amazing work here protecting the environment. I mean, there are many companies that are global plan here. There's another organization called Global Plan. Oh, sorry, I've got to remember this one. Yeah, they do a lot around air pollution, because I often support, every June as Air Clean Air Day. So I often do a talk or presentation or work with them in the year, and do a campaign in June each year. So yeah, because the miners, again, underground, the air was poor quality. There was poisonous gases, methane gases underground. So clean air for me, if the miners had clean air, not that they could have ever had that underground, but clean air is a major kind of campaign that I am passionate about, because we need clean air, and mining, you know, miners didn't have that opportunity to have that underground. So that's something that some of them who are still, you know, many have died, people that I've interviewed, they've passed away because of ill health and old age as well, but many of them through complaints and lung diseases. Yeah. We just got to think about that and learn from it and do better.
Okay. Well, on that note, we are going to our next break. So maybe people can make some donations while they're on their break, and we will be right back after that. So we were on break, and you were just telling me about really interesting history and a new project that you've been working on related to Windrush. So can you tell our listeners that are not based in the UK what that is and the work that you've been doing related to it?
Yes. Well, in June 1948, HMS Windrush was a big ship that brought passengers from all over the world, all over the Commonwealth, to the UK. And on that ship were many people from many nationalities and many from the West Indies. And they came to the UK, again, through invitation from the British government at that time to help rebuild Britain following World War II. So many took up the opportunity of contributing to the British economy and British way of life and workforce. And many of them worked on the railways, in the hospitals. My mother worked in the NHS for 40 years. She came to the UK in 1965, and my father came in 1962, and he worked in the iron industry. And some worked in the coal mines as well for many years. So it was all that kind of supporting what they were taught in the Caribbean, that England was the mother country, and they came to help, which they did for many decades, many years. However, in 2018, a big kind of scandal emerged in the UK news through a story in a newspaper called The Guardian newspaper, and it was around the disposal of important documents that should have been archived, that were part of the Home Office department, regarding people, passengers on that ship and in that time in the late 1940s and 50s, and particularly people from the Caribbean, from Jamaica, from Barbados and other countries. And there was an attempt to remove them, that many people were removed from the country, deported, not allowed to work, having been accused of being an illegal immigrant, illegal citizen of the UK, despite having being British citizens. So this was a big issue in 2018. So sadly, people have died through the stress and pain and treatment. So since that time, there has been some justice happened. We have now a Windrush commissioner, Reverend Clive Foster, a good friend of mine, who is from Nottingham. And his role now is to help make sure justice happens, which is the legal right of British citizens to be living here. Being British is not white alone. There are people with brown skin, dark skin, fair skin. That doesn't determine your citizenship, the skin colour. So that is a big issue. But my role is to support the development of a new Windrush Museum that is being created. We've been able to contribute some of the content that I've spoken about, that I've been able to create with the miners and with the general public and volunteers. We've been able to contribute some of this content within this new Windrush Museum that is being made. A lot of the content, some of it is going online, but eventually will be in its own building in London or in somewhere central where all people can visit and learn about the Windrush community, the Windrush generation, and their contribution to the UK and the global space that we are all in. So because it was a global issue, really, because there were people from all over the world being treated unfairly. So that's a major project that I'm helping. I'm making sure the mining history, the miners' stories and the miners' voices and images are seen in this new Windrush Museum. I've also helped with helping to preserve the history of the carnival in Nottingham. Nottingham's had its own carnival from 1958. Also, London started their first carnival in London in 1958 as well. So carnival history is an amazing story. Obviously, you have the Mardi Gras in New Orleans. So carnival is a time of celebration, but it's a time of reflection and memory as well, of pain and why, you know, people's voices were not allowed to express themselves in 19th century on plantations and during the time of enslavery of African and Caribbean people. So that was a project that I was really passionate about, and really, it really made me appreciate having a voice and working with other people and celebrating life. So those are the kind of projects that I'm involved in, helping to preserve national history, inclusive history, and global history.
Yeah. Okay. You beat me to asking you about that. So, okay. Can you tell us a little bit more about what specifically you're doing on Carnival, like on the preservation work or the education work, or what your role has been there?
My role with the Nottingham Carnival Heritage Project was to project manage it, collect as many stories and newspaper articles and photographs, which were not preserved. They were all over the place. People had the photos in their own collections. Tun Housing Association in Nottingham, England, it was one of their projects. So they asked me to come on board and support them and lead it and create a successful end, which we did, which was an amazing carnival and exhibition. And the public were involved from start to finish. And it was supported by the National Lottery Heritage Fund at the time. So that was amazing. Just one of the kind of projects that I've worked on. I always work with projects where we are using history, we're using archaeology to help us think about the past and look at the remnants of the past and how we can make it relevant to today, and how important themes such as teamwork and our social kind of networks and cohesion that we need to survive, you know, how it fits into some of the activities that we do every day that we've never really thought about them in detail. So I'm very much into bringing history alive and celebrating it as well.
Okay, so that super interesting. And I love the range of different types of projects that you're working on there. There's a theme, but they're also different and interesting and unique, each of them. And okay, so I'm curious, especially like going back to the industrial heritage, mining, you know, I think there's kind of a lack of interest a lot of times on the archaeology front, anthropology, et cetera, to study this kind of more recent history, this, you know, quote unquote, less sexy history. And can you talk about, like, A, why you think that is, but B, why you think it shouldn't be that way?
Yeah, well, I think there may seem to be a drop in interest in archaeology. I think, again, it's back to being inclusive. If you're looking at stories where you learn about different cultures and not just kind of one-dimensional history, and I think for me, that's been my experience growing up at school, learning about purely kings and queens and battles won, battles lost. It's not just that, you know, we're more than that. And I think when university courses start to widen their curriculum, what they are allowing students to look into or talk about, what they're teaching students, I think when they widen topics, doing some things that are risky, talking about things which are challenging, debating, you know, talking about difficult histories. But what is difficult? You know, is difficult things that make certain dominant cultures look bad? You know, I think I think once lecturers, educators, universities, once we start being just a bit more honest and open, you're going to find more interest in it. Time is limited for many people. People are very busy. So I think making it more relatable and hooking, giving people a hook, showing people how history and our archaeology relates to them. You know, once you start understanding what's related to you, like, for instance, the house I'm living in, this land, literally the house where I'm living in right now, and the land was owned by Henry Molyneux, was the father of Carnarvon, Lord Carnarvon, who discovered Tutankhamun. He owned the land right here. He was the mayor of Nottinghamshire, Henry Molyneux. So it's just intrigued me. I'm now looking into Egyptology and Egyptian history because it's related to me. I can relate to it, which nobody, you know, I discovered that in the deeds of my property. I read my deeds and discovered names and started to research the names and then found out about the Carnarvon history and Tutankhamun. So, you know what I mean? So I'm just trying to say, you know, you wouldn't think Tutankhamun's got anything to do with me, but it has indirectly. So it's just, again, ignited my passion and interest and intrigue around history and archaeology. So I'm just trying to encourage people to open their eyes and think differently. Read a document that you've never seen before. Go to the archives, look at old documents and just read through. Start to ask questions. Start to think about your local area. What's here? What's been here before? What was on this site before the shops. So for instance, again, back to my local area in Nottinghamshire, all the former coal mines that were here, there were over 50 in Nottinghamshire and the border where we border Derbyshire and Leicestershire, over 50 mines in this city alone, around this city and county. They are now shopping, supermarkets are built on top of this land. Housing developments are built on top of mines. Parks, country parks and parks where people can go and walk, they were once mines, you know, the men were going underground, but they're all obviously capped now. These mines are all capped, but they are there, you know, but they just, sometimes you don't think what was here on this land before the housing estate, before the shopping mall, before the shopping centres, you know. So those are the things that really interest me. And that's really igniting and burning my flame and fire for archaeology now. It's so intriguing.
I love it. Okay, so speaking of burning your fire for archaeology, what are you excited about coming up? Like, what are you wanting to work on?
Well, what my dream is, I want to work closer with some of the museums, industrial museums in America, your mining museums there. I'm yet to visit them. So I'd love to do some partnership work or do some talks at the universities and just to share our knowledge from the UK with the US citizens as well. And just work closer with the museums there, helping them to reconsider, reflect on some of the interpretation that's in industrial heritage museums, looking at, you know, what are the pictures saying? Whose face is missing on the wall in an exhibition when you walk around? Whose voice is not there? Whose image is not there? Those are the gaps that I want to work with museums, industrial heritage museums. I want to help fix that. Just start to ask, you know, whose face could we put there? Whose voice could we put there? Just to make it a bit more inclusive. And in that way, you'll invite more people to come to that museum, to come and see the exhibition and interpretation once they can see representation. So I think that's something that I'm going to pursue next year. I'm also going to be attending next week I go to Dubai to the International Conference of, I'm a member of ICOM, which is the International Council of Museums. And every three years, they have a major conference in the world. And this year it's in Dubai. So I will be attending that conference, representing the UK and sharing our knowledge with our fellow historians and archaeologists and industrial heritage specialists. I'll be working globally, and that's where I want to be. I actually want to work more on a global partnership level with other historians and archaeologists, thinking about some of the challenges and problems that we're all facing across the world and how we're going to discuss, debate, and shape the space that heritage and archaeology is privileged to take up in the world. Yes, I want to help shape that. So that's, you know, that's something that I'll be doing very soon. And really just enjoying my work. I really love what I do. It is different from classroom teaching, but occasionally I do go back into the classroom to speak to the young people about the, you know, encouraging them to keep on learning and questioning and taking part in their own life journey. So I want industry and archaeology, industrial heritage, to be part of everyone's everyday thinking. And yeah, I want to help shape the future of industrial history.
Okay, listeners, putting a call out there. If anybody knows anybody in industrial or heritage, you know, mining museums, you know, you'll know where to find Dr. Gregory and help make her dreams come true. And yeah, so we're already at the end, which is, it just always comes so fast. But so if there's anything that you feel like, oh man, I really wanted to say this, or this is, you know, my one soapbox thing that I want everyone to know about, you know, industrial mining heritage or industrial heritage of the African diaspora, like, this is the one thing. What do you got for us?
Well, the one thing I would like people to learn Well, yeah. I would like people to stay in contact. If they want to see some of our work, please visit our website at blackcoalminers.com. There is loads on social media, on LinkedIn and other platforms to see some of the work in progress. Please email with any comments or any questions or any way I can help you understand more about industrial history in your own region, your own country. Please feel free to get in touch and I'll do my best to support you in your search and in your own learning.
That's amazing.
Thank you.
Love it. Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much again for taking time out of your schedule to come and speak to our listeners about this topic. Very cool. And as I said before, very cool to get different perspectives on the podcast. So anyone that's listening, if you know of somebody that you feel like we're missing, like there's a gap in the things we've talked about, and we need to talk to somebody in particular, or you want us to talk on a specific topic, just reach out to me and let me know so we can make sure you're getting what you want. So again, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And I hope you hear from some of our listeners.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.